Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 300. Yay! Yay! We can't have the big party that we had for 100th episode because, you know, big parties aren't allowed during the era of COVID. But that did not preclude us from having a fabulous, fabulous episode with someone very special. Someone who I just, if you had told me, Kristen, you know, 25 years ago, whenever I started using 3D Studio in DOS on a 486 computer, if you ever told me that I will be doing a podcast with Gary Yost, first of all, I would have said, what the hell is a podcast? Because they didn't exist back then. But I would also just not believe it because he is really, really, really great. He is an amazing person. He's the guy who basically started 3D Studio and did incredible things, including its transition to Windows when he went and did Macs as well, and does some incredible things. I've been a fan of Gary Yost's work for a long time and his philosophy and all the products he's done. But it's not until this podcast that I became a fan of Gary Yost, the person, who was surprising in his excitement and everything. Wasn't he amazing?
Yeah. Like, I didn't expect all the stuff that he said he was going to say. Like, he's just an amazing person.
Yeah.
Outside of even the CG world, just everything. Really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was really revealing a bunch of stuff to us, you know, that was very interesting about, you know, what it's been like to be him, you know, going, and he had a lot of health issues when he was in his past and dealing with all those things. And it was really, really incredible to hear about that, as well as the fact that, you know, he really wanted to be an artist when he started. He wanted to create cool looking stuff, and he made the program to do the stuff. And it wasn't until much later in his life that he got to be an artist and be creative in a lot of ways. So it's really great to see that out of Gary and hear all those stories. He was really, also what's really nice about him is that he basically just kept on talking and I just let him talk, and he said really great stories. I will note that even though we're doing a video podcast, we're using a new system now for doing video podcasts, which I think will look really good. I'm excited about that. Unfortunately, that system was not quite working with Gary when we did it, and we lost his video feed. So you won't, if we look, go to our YouTube, he won't be there. His video is not working, but you can still hear all of his stories and it still sounds great. So sorry about that, Gary, but I'm sure it's fine. Almost everyone listens to these podcasts anyway, so it's fine. But okay, that enough about this. The 300th episode is really great. It's been almost exactly 6 years that I started this. I can't believe it that it's been 6 years, and I hope for many more years to come. All right. So that being said, Kristen, what are some announcements that we have?
All right. So you can find these out at chaosgroup.com/events. The first one we've talked about a lot, few weeks left, is the Illumination Challenge. The deadline is November 30th. And the next one is just something small. It's a webinar. It's on November 24th. Sorry, not small, but they will be talking about VRA 5 for 3DS Max, and it will be in Russian. So if you know how to speak Russian or listen to it. It'll showcase the latest features and benefits of version 5. So,
and all of these can be found. And all of these can be found online. So chaosgroup.com/events is where you found that information. In terms of products, our big announcements, by the day that this podcast comes out, which is Monday the something.
Ninth.
I think. V-Ray 5 for SketchUp will be out. So make sure and check it out. Lots and lots and lots of new features that are really cool. So there's going to be some very cool things to look it up. Look it up on our site, chaosgroup.com, and get all your information about V-Ray 5 for SketchUp, which is going to be pertinent to our current, a lot of things that you guys may be doing. So I'd really like to hear your feedback and your ideas on V-Ray 5 for SketchUp. All right. Is that it? Is that all the announcements we have, Kristen?
Yep, that's all.
That's it? Okay. All right. That being said, please enjoy this incredible podcast, number 300, with Mr. Gary Yost.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell. You need to make sure everything has Fernell.
Yeah, so as we were saying just before we started recording is that basically I was really sort of learning Matsuo's 3D Studio was the first real big 3D package that I would used quite a bit. And this was back in 93, I guess was when
so,
it was.
So, you know, that was release 3, I think.
Yeah.
No, maybe it was still 90. It was released 2 in 93. I think 94 might have been release 3. It's hard to remember all the release schedules.
Yeah. And yeah, I just.
So, well, good luck to you. I mean.
It's kind of funny because I remember, you know, sitting there like, it's like, wow, this software is really cool. I mean, it's great. And it runs on a PC, you know, and it wasn't, you know, you didn't need these $50,000 SGIs to run it. And you could do an enormous amount of it. It was super friendly for what I was trying to do. It worked, you know, at that time I was doing some modeling in AutoCAD mostly, you know, I was trying to like experiment with it, and it was a really cool thing. And I think I remember, you know, saying like, this Yoast group guys are really cool. And I just can't imagine that I'm sitting here talking to Gary Yoast at the same time.
Yeah. I'm still alive.
Yeah.
So it's kind of 30 years later.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It is kind of funky to think about that and what that means. But how did you even get into programming and computer graphics? I mean, where did all that all start? What was your inspiration to get into that?
Okay, we go way back.
Yeah.
Probably the mid 70s, 74, 75.
Yeah.
I was still in high school and my friends and I, we made little 8mm movies, and we had, you know, a dark room, and we would take pictures, and we would sit around occasionally smoking pot and dreaming about this kind of virtual studio that didn't exist yet. And
right.
How, you know, one day we'd be able to, you know, in our bedrooms even, make movies. Who knew, you know? And we even had a word for it. We called it Surreally Studios.
Okay.
And, you know, we were influenced by, you know, the great kind of auteurs, you know, Truffaut and all these people who kind of did it all themselves.
Right.
And, you know, Buñuel and all these guys who showed us that, you know, if you were super creative, you could manage an awful lot of the process. And so this was in the 70s. And I also, at the time, I had some really serious health problems growing up. I was born with an autoimmune disorder. I was born without a spleen, and it led to just a cascade of autoimmune disorders throughout my early teens and throughout my teens. And I ended up not being able to go to school very much. I was in the hospital a lot during my mid-teens and late teens, and although I got accepted to Northwestern University and a couple other schools, I ended up getting a diploma after 2.5 years of high school and not being able to go to college because I wasn't well enough. And I ended up just kind of working in the sound business, doing like with a cousin actually, who got me a job in it with a sound company, and kind of working in the sound business, wanted to work in lighting, wanted to do more theatrical work. And by 1980, I had kind of gotten out of that, got my FCC first class phone operator's license to be a television engineer, did all that studying by myself. And around that time is when, you know, the Apple II was coming out and the Timex Sinclair was coming out.
Yeah.
And so I
had a Sinclair ZX88.
That's exactly what I had. Yeah.
Nice.
Do you remember what year that was exactly? Was that 81?
It was about, I want to say
81.
You could have, yeah, about that. Yeah.
It might have been an 80. I don't know if it was an 88. And, yeah. So I taught myself how to program in BASIC on it.
Yeah, that's all I had.
Yeah. And I, you know, was moving little dots around on the screen.
I think he had 40 pixels by 88 pixels or something like that.
Oh, wow, that many. Yeah. And I just loved this act of moving something around on a virtual screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't able to do much work because I was still had a lot of physical issues at the time. Mm-hmm. And actually, by late 1981, early 1982, I developed colon cancer.
Oh, dear.
I was only 23 years old.
Oof.
And it was just the craziest thing. On the way, on the way to this process of all these surgeries I had in 1982, I had this crazy idea to write a letter to the CEO of Atari, asking if he would just make me some sort of ward of Atari. I had looked at like the Apple II and the Atari 800, mm-hmm. which had just come out, and the Atari 800 had this, you know, Antic chip, and it could do sprites. And it was obviously much more tuned to graphics.
Right.
And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. Better than the Apple II. And so I it was the craziest thing. One day I wrote this two paragraph letter to Ray Kassar. Raymond Kassar was the CEO of Atari in 1982 when it was owned by Time Warner.
Okay.
And I told him what I was about to go through with all these surgeries that year, and I made some hokey comment at the end about whether or not there still was a Santa Claus. I mean, no shit. I actually pulled that out of the hat. And I really didn't think anything was going to become of it. I mean, I literally called, 408-555-1212, asked for Atari's number, asked the secretary the name of the CEO and what their mailing address was.
Right.
And I wrote this two-paragraph one-pager. Uh-huh. And that was like in March of 1982, and my surgery was in June. And it was like 6 weeks later. Nothing happened for 6 weeks. And so maybe May sometime, middle of May, just a few weeks before I was going to go in the hospital, I got this little, I still have it. Gosh, it's over in this cabinet over there. I got this little white envelope in the mailbox, and I didn't even like notice a return. There was no return address. It was just this white envelope. But then I could feel this embossed thing on the corner, and it was the embossed Atari logo.
Oh, wow.
I was like, what the fuck? And I opened it up, and I pulled this card out, and it was from the desk of Raymond Kassar. And in it, he says, oh, you know, hi there. Loved your letter. You sound like a really brave young man. I'm going to hook you up as a grantee with the Atari Institute for Educational Action Research.
Okay.
Which was a fairly, like, going concern run by this great man named Ted Kahn.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of adopted me as their prototypical user who had to work remotely on projects. And I became the beta tester for their control data Plato terminal emulator.
Okay.
Which they were doing along with CDC, right? CDC made these really expensive touchscreen Plato terminals in 1982. Right. And they had a network. I mean, the cyber Plato terminals were the prototype, you know, that was the internet then.
Right.
And they had terminals in prisons, and you could get on and chat with prisoners. And my it was amazing. You could chat with people all over the world. And it was this great bitmapped display that you had to, you press a button on the joystick and you could zoom in to see the full, you know, display and scroll around over the virtual display. And so I helped them like work out the bugs in that. And it was a tough year, 1982. But I also, I learned more BASIC. I learned some Pascal. Because there was a Pascal package for the 800, and I taught myself how to do that. I was not like a great, I was never a great programmer because my mind is way too nonlinear.
Okay.
I would have been diagnosed with ADHD as a kid if there was that diagnosis then.
Right.
And so I taught myself how to do these things. I understood how it worked. I took some assembly language classes at University of California, Berkeley, like non-matriculating evening classes.
Okay.
Just to learn kind of a little bit how the architecture worked. And I asked the people at Atari if they could introduce me to somebody who was involved in the, like another user. And they introduced me to a guy named Jim Caparel, who had a Atari magazine called Antic. Mm-hmm. And I needed a job, and like he needed a guy to sell ad space in Antic. So in the end of 1982, from my home, I was able to start selling ad space. And then I don't know exactly when it was, but Jack Tramiel bought Atari from Warner Brothers in, I think it was like end of 83 or early 84.
Okay.
And the user-based Atari software catalog. So Atari had this thing called the Atari Program Exchange, where end users who wrote little programs could get them self-published through this very informal publishing arm of Atari. But okay. When Tramiel bought the company, he just cut all that loose. Mm-hmm. And there were quite a few really good programs, including one called the Deep Blue Sea Compiler. And so there was like a C compiler somebody had wrote for the Atari 800.
Wow.
And so I called that guy up, and I forget his name right now. But he agreed to sign with us, and we started this little catalog inside of Antic magazine with the C compiler. And we then picked up another dozen, programmers who had published cool pieces of software, and kind of had a pretty large catalog of these independent things. And when the Atari ST came out and the 68000 enabled, more complex things, we wanted to branch out. And we saw that that Tom Hudson had written a 2D paint program for a company called Batteries Included in Toronto. And it was the best 2D paint program on the ST. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was like the only one at the time outside of Atari's Neo paint program, which was shipped with the computer.
Right.
And it was great. And so I called up Tom, and I although he worked for our arch rival Analog magazine, there were two Atari magazines at the time. One was the West Coast Antic with the West Coast hippies, and then there's the Boston-based Analog with all the button-down, hardworking types. And so I was like, hey, Tom, I'd really like to work with you on a new graphics program, because that's where my true love is. I know that, we could do some interesting things together. And then he said, this was probably in October or November of 1985 or something.
Okay.
And he said, well, let's get together at Comdex in December. In Vegas. Okay. And so we met up, and he showed up with a little 3.5-inch floppy disk, and we put it in the demo unit, and he brought up this thing called Solid States. And it was essentially had a whole bunch of lists, it was a vertex and a face list, and it could display a little rotating cube in a little viewport.
Right.
And he said, well, this is what I want to do next. I want to do 3D. And and I said, it's great. This is what I want to do also.
Right.
And I said, by the way, have you seen what they're showing over at the Apple booth across the street? Because we were in the old funky West Hall at Vegas, street.
Yeah. And
let me take you across the street to the big hall where Apple's showing this thing called Easy 3D.
Okay.
And it was the first 3D thing on the Mac. By a company called Enabling Technologies out of Chicago. And we brought him over there, and we grabbed the demo guy and said, show us this thing. And so he took us through Easy 3D, and then me and Tom walked away from the booth, and Tom looked at me and said, oh, I can do that much better.
Right.
And I was like, great, let's get going. And it was like a week later, he gave me the first prototype of CAD 3D.
Okay.
Which was our, 68000 based Atari thing. And that ended up turning into a whole line of software. So that was 85, you know, that probably came out in 86, and 86, mm-hmm. 87, 8, we, you know, we went through CAD 3D 2.0, and then a guy named Mark Kimball at Tektronix, who loved CAD 3D, gave me a call one day and said, I think you need to get a plane ticket up to Portland. I have something to show you. And so I got on a plane to Portland. I showed up at Tektronix, and you know, Tektronix, right? Mm-hmm. Very large industrial scientific corporation.
Yep.
And I meet up with Mark. He gives me a badge. He takes me back. There's a 68,000 running Atari. So yeah, it says Atari 68,000. And I was like, what's that? And he boots up CAD 3D. And wow. then he reaches behind the thing and he brings out a pair of goggles. And I'm like, what's that? He says, these are liquid crystal shutter glasses. And I wrote using the API that Tom put into CAD 3D, because we were the first people that had any sort of an API into our code. I wrote a program that takes the display list out of the ST and it synchronizes it with these goggles. And so you can now do things stereoscopically. You can render stereoscopically just by pressing this button in this little plug-in to CAD 3D. And I put it on, and you had to dim the lights because it was like 15 hertz per eye.
Oh, oof. That's a little low.
And, but you know, like, holy cow, you know?
Yeah.
He had things, it was incredible. And so he said, you know, I think I've convinced the powers that be here, we could do a consumer product that you could sell along with CAD 3D. And we ended up coming out with this thing called Stereotech. And it was this pair of goggles that, you know, you can Google it.
Right.
And then we, you know, we did a whole bunch of other add-ons using this API that Tom had put in. You know, there was like an anti-aliasing thing, and then there was a whole scripting language and other little things that we added on. And we saw, like, this is the power of an API in a 3D package. And then, you know, we would go to Comdex again for each of those subsequent 2 years and show this stuff, and people from Autodesk would come by.
Right.
And look at it and go, you know, whoa, you know.
Right.
And the first year they offered us jobs, and we said, no.
Yep.
No. And then the second year they came and they said, you know, how would you like a publishing deal where, you know, you can take a crack at doing something like the 3D, like that, like 3D content creation system, kind of like the AutoCAD of 3D. And you know, we jumped at that, and you know, so we got this contract with Autodesk to do the AutoCAD of 3D, you know, really had no idea what we were doing. And, you know, it was by looking at other software that was out there at the time, like Wavefront, that you were familiar with. And Vertigo, actually, was very inspiring. I'm sure you could see a lot of similarities between the Vertigo modeling tools and our Lofter.
I loved the Lofter. And it was so cool. You know, I played with the Lofter for so long. I remember just sitting there for hours, like, okay, this shape here, and then this curves here. It was so much fun. It was amazing.
Yeah, and that was really inspired by Vertigo. They did really great things. If I haven't thanked them until now, I would do that now. So, you know, so we, you know, we did that, and then really it you know, it started to snowball. But of course, the real story behind all this is the collaborations between all the really talented people. So of course, by now you've already picked up on the fact that this relationship I had with Tom had a lot of synergy associated with it. And you know, what we also used to call back in the Cirilli studio days, high causality.
Okay.
And I really saw how, you know, how useful this synergy was in as a force multiplier. And and so we were looking for, you know, someone to do all the keyframing and animation stuff. And there was a guy at Autodesk in the product management department, a guy named Walt Spivak, who still lives down the road from me here in Mill Valley. And I had been lamenting to him, you know, that we didn't really have an engineer who could do the keyframer, and how I really subscribe to the Rock Band theory of software development teams, in that all the members had to meld on a, to create a gestalt that was kind of this unified. I had been a musician when I was a kid, so I understood the feeling of flow that happens when you're playing music with other people. And I wanted to recapture that feeling of flow. And one day Walt came up to me and said, my neighbor in Mill Valley and I were literally talking over the backyard fence the other day. And he told me that he was really unhappy with his current publisher, Electronic Arts.
Okay.
And I was like, well, who's your neighbor? He's like, well, Dan Silva. And I happened to have known Dan Silva, I think at a SIGGRAPH in Atlanta, we walked from the hotel to the hall together a couple years prior to that. And he was such a great guy. And I heard Walt say his name and I kind of knew instantly that this was going to be a wonderful opportunity. And so we asked Dan to come into Autodesk facility at 2320 Marin Ship Way, the old facility by the boat docks. And I was really adamant about not telling him what we wanted. I wanted to hear what he wanted to do. And if what he wanted to do was aligned with, where we were at, it was going to mean a lot. So we asked him what he wanted to do. And he said two things. And, I wish I could remember what the first thing was, but it was like completely off the wall and not relevant to anything that we were doing. But the second thing was, I'd love to do a keyframer for a 3D animation package.
Oh, perfect.
And it was like, that's boom. We all were in the room. I mean, Tom was in the room and, we were all in the room. And, you could just feel it, right?
Right.
And so you're hired. And that was in September of 1991. And we dealt with all the contractual stuff. And I went to Dan's house on October 21st, 1989. What am I saying? Because I went to his house on October 21st, 1989. And he signed the contract. And I took that contract over back to Autodesk. And that's when the earthquake happened. The big earthquake in October of 1989. Yeah. So that was a really big day.
Yep.
On so many levels. And the Autodesk was built on fill. So the whole building was, really moving a lot. And it became quite an exciting day. I'll never forget it. And so now we had, Dan and Tom, and there were a bunch of issues to work out. Windows was, didn't exist yet, or was actually, it was 16-bit. So it was useless for addressing large memory.
Right. And it was Windows 3.1 or 3.0 at that point or something like that, right?
It had very pathetic memory addressing ability. And so we were just working under DOS.
Right.
And we were using the FarLap extender, which was a 32-bit kind of memory management kind of framework. And so Dan and Tom sprinted. And so the synergy was like, so again, this goes back to this issue of flow and collaboration. And without going into tons of details, because the story from there, I mean, we brought in, we had this really great API in release 2 of 3D Studio called iPass. Which allowed anyone to write these extensions, and we used that as a testbed to really understand what a good API, ought to look like. How a non-modal, it was just the iPass thing just only went so far. But we were looking. So what we were trying to do was create this collaborative sense of flow among all the developers of the world.
Yeah.
And so we had. We had noticed that one of our great iPass enthusiasts was this, I think he was a teenager named Rolf Berteig up in Seattle. And he was just prolific and, one of those people who had a pure can-do attitude. There was no challenge was too much. In fact, challenges weren't even a challenge. They were just an exciting opportunity for him. And And he was super young, you know, and we were already 30, you know, we were already getting right. pretty old. And so we offered Rolf a full partnership in the Yoast Group. So Tom and I were already full partners. And then we essentially, we just made him a full partner. So now we were thirds. Mm-hmm. And we asked him to write the inverse kinematics package.
Right.
And so he wrote this beautiful inverse kinematics package. And at the same time, of course, while he was writing that, we were coming up against the limitations of the iPass interface really hard.
Right.
And just the overall limitations of the DOS platform. And Microsoft had come to us and showed us some very, very early versions of Windows NT.
Okay, yeah.
Right, so we saw...
Windows 4 or Windows NT. Yeah.
Yeah, it was 32-bit memory addressing. And,
right.
And so, you know, we immediately saw the writing on the wall. Like, we either could just basically stop here, mm-hmm. or we just start over from scratch, essentially. And but we needed to continue supporting our code. And I had a casual relationship with the chief scientist at Wavefront, this incredibly brilliant man, Don Britton.
Okay.
Dr. Don Britton. Uh-huh. And so I called him up at Wavefront and said, "Hey man, we'll make you a full partner, you know, with us. We'll go foursies.
Okay.
If you want to play with us and, you know, and help us, you know, rewrite." 'Cause actually he had come to me at Autodesk to show him the kinds of experiments he was doing with Windows NT, like just a couple weeks prior. Like Microsoft went to Wavefront also and showed him that. And he had done some experiments, but Wavefront did not want to go to Windows and he was disappointed. Mm-hmm. And so I call him up and say, "Hey, you're interested in Windows? Let's do this Windows thing." And he said, "Well, actually Microsoft just offered me a job in Seattle as being like chief scientist of blah, 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 blah."
All right.
And I was, you know, disheartened.
Right.
But I didn't give up. And I worked really hard over the next few weeks to convince him that staying in Santa Barbara, beautiful Santa Barbara where he was living, was going to be a much better proposition than having to move up to rainy Seattle.
Okay.
Because they were requiring him to move with his wife and two daughters.
Yep.
And that was the thing that really, you know, allowed him to say no to Microsoft and yes to us. And again, like going back to this issue of collaboration,
right,
and flow, Don, while we were doing like the release 4.5 of 3DS DOS,
right,
he was bringing up all this architecture, really inspired a lot by, you know, what we had seen from Symbolics.
Okay.
So the primary inspiration for Max was really what had happened at Symbolics and what they had done with Lisp and all that. And,
oh, right.
You know, we were standing on the shoulders of the giants of, you know, the previous 10 years. I mean, I could go through the litany of all these amazing people who had, you know, who were our inspiration, right? And then going back to Dr. Sutherland before all that. But we don't have the time to go through, like, the amazing people who we were inspired by.
Right.
But, you know, Craig from Symbolics, who, you know, so we wanted to do something that great, but a little bit more accessible. And so Don did that in the background while we finished up our DOS obligations. And, you know, we came out with this version 1 of Max, which was really 0.7 or something,
right,
in 1995 or 96. Like, so we showed it in 95, blew the doors off SIGGRAPH when we showed. Microsoft had just bought Soft Image.
I remember.
They thought they were such hot shit. And then we showed, you know, Michael Gerard and Susan Amkraut's bipedal animation thing and all sorts of stuff. And we had these huge crowds. We were like, what the fuck? Where did that come from? Like, we had kept it a really good secret we were doing. And, so on that note about blowing the doors off of SIGGRAPH, I'll take you back to SIGGRAPH 1989. when Alias had found out about what we were doing on the PC with 3DS DOS, we showed the first DOS version in July of 1989. Alias issued a memo to all of their staff and sales reps about how our little DOS toy was no threat to Alias and that they should not worry about it because, you know, it's just this Autodesk is a nobody and they're never going to get anywhere in the field of 3D. And you can just forget about these guys. And I don't know if I still have that memory. It was so funny. It was all being passed around. Did you see this? They're fucking scared of you guys. So now we jump to SIGGRAPH 1995 and like the Microsoft people, they're all standing there going,
But then why did Microsoft buy Softimage?
I mean,
they wanted to do that just to move people over to Windows. That must have been, you know, they wanted to get a piece of that pie, right?
That was a big reason. They wanted to show Windows as being a, professional content creation platform. I mean, they had all the money in the world.
They just bought them and then they dumped them right after that.
Yeah, it was a little while. It wasn't immediate. But yeah, it was, I mean, that's a whole other side story. I remember pieces of that story, but not all the details. But it made some people very, very rich.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm sure.
Really. We had all this flow going on. We were with a small team of really four people. It was Don and Rolf and Dan and me. And then, you know, a couple other, Gus Gruba was a really important part of our team. And then Jack Powell was our tech writer and, resident human.
Now, Phil was telling me you guys were doing a lot of work remotely from different locations. This is one of the first times that anyone had really done that.
Boy, that's a great story. That's kind of worth noting. So, that's kind of funny. So up until 1993.
Right.
The source library was very easy to manage between Tom and Dan with check-ins and just with two people, it just was doable. Uh-huh. And we were using 1200 baud modems and it's not like the repository was huge or anything.
Okay.
And then, Don did his thing. And then when we started to, I wish I could remember the exact dates, but we were about to sign the contract with Autodesk for Macs.
Okay.
And we hadn't signed it yet, but, we were a functioning team and we were trying to put together a repository with some sort of a source management program that worked. And we were still using 1200 baud modems. And
that's fast.
Well, it wasn't even the speed. We were just getting line drops and things that were... Yeah. The speed would have been one thing. It would have been fine, but we just didn't have the reliability we needed.
Right.
And it was like literally the week I was supposed to sign the contract with Carol Bartz, at Autodesk. And I was pretty despondent. I actually thought that I wasn't going to be able to sign the contract because Tom was in Kansas. Dan was here in Marin County. I was in San Francisco. Don was in Santa Barbara. And no one was going to move. I mean, that was the whole point, was that we were decentralized, which allowed us all to work, 110-hour work weeks.
Right.
And our wives would just kind of take care of us and, feed us food every once in a while. And and that was because, that again, our force multiplier was that we just had all these efficiencies. We didn't have to deal with water cooler gossip and office politics and all that crap.
Right.
And so, like I said, I was despondent and didn't think I'd be able to sign the contract because we were having such problems. And Gus Gruba, who was, he was in California at the time, in the mountains, when I was, bitching to him about this problem, he said that he had just heard about ISDN, that this, integrated services.
A new kind of internet.
Network. It's like this reliable, reliable high-speed internet. I don't remember what the speed was. It was maybe,
I think it was like 4,800 or something.
4,800 or maybe 96, maybe.
Maybe.
but like super reliable. And if you could get it to your house, it'd be fine. But not all houses had it available. So we all checked with our local, phone operators. And one of us didn't have it at the time, but convinced the phone company to get it. Okay. Might have been Tom. I forget, but it might have been Tom. And after lots of negotiating with the phone company and pleading, you know, we all got a commitment to get it. And then I was able to sign the contract with Autodesk. And then, yeah, we did the entire thing remotely. So what we would do is we would get together for like 5 days at my house in San Francisco. I had a big old house in San Francisco, and my wife would leave and stay with the friend in Santa Fe. And, you know, we would all just live there for a week while we went through all of our lists of, you know, task lists of things that we needed to do.
Sure.
And it was these crazy, you know, all day sessions, and we, you know, hit the local Chinese restaurant for dinner and get, you know, look, study our fortunes from the fortune cookies very carefully.
Right.
And I started to tape these fortunes from the fortune cookies into the specs that I would give to Autodesk. There would be like, everyone would have like a fortune, like, your plans are going to succeed. And they look with an arrow, be like, look.
Nice.
And I think our code name for the first version of Max was Jaguar.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I still have all those specs somewhere. I could, you know, share them. Wow. I'm sure Tom has them. He has everything.
Wow.
And so, you know, that's how we did it. So we'd get together and then we'd just go back to our houses. We'd work for like 12 months on a release. And then we would, then we'd kind of take a break for a month. And then it actually got to be 17 month release cycles.
Okay.
And, you know, we did that for two releases and there was a fair amount of burnout because, you know, we were five people with Jack and maybe six with Gus. And it was literally 110 hour weeks. And, you know, we had no days off. I was very tough on the guys.
Yeah.
And we had these obligations and we had this shot at it. And Tom got married before we shipped, I don't know, release two maybe.
Okay.
And he wanted to go on a honeymoon. I think he'd even made reservations, flight reservations and hotel reservations in Australia. And I had to be a real asshole and tell him that he had to cancel those and go after we shipped in April. And it was hard on me to be that kind of a jerk. But we had these obligations. And so, you know, we got through release two, and then it became really obvious that this was going to be a hamster wheel that was going to go on interminably.
Right.
Little did I know, right? 2020, it's the 30th anniversary.
Right.
Interminably.
Yeah, it's the 30th anniversary. Yeah, it's true.
Interminably. Yeah. And in addition, my health issues hadn't gone away. I had had surgery in 1982, but it was actually I'm not going to get into any details, but it was an experimental surgery. I was the first person with this surgery in San Francisco, and it didn't actually go very well. And I had been suffering with the side effects of this experimental surgery for 18 years. And I was in and out of the hospital throughout this whole experience. I mean, there were SIGGRAPHs where I'd be in the emergency room of the hospital before the show started. I don't, you know, if anyone remembers the SIGGRAPH in Orlando in 1994, I think, where I didn't show up till like noon or 1 o'clock the first day of the show because I was in the emergency room.
Wow.
Getting transfused, getting blood transfusions.
Wow.
Right? And and then there was in early 1997, I was in the hospital. I just had a stroke.
Oh my gosh.
And it was a small stroke, but I lost the use of my right arm and leg for a while. And it was just obvious that the schedule was killing me.
Right.
And I had to get out. And I had no leverage at all with Autodesk. Although we owned these patents and we owned all the intellectual property, they owned the right to market the program.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They owned the rights to do anything with it. So we couldn't go to someone else and say, hey, you know, would you like to get into the 3D business with this thing? We were over a barrel with them. And so, I mean, we had to hire a mergers and acquisition, you know, commercial bank to negotiate there was this guy, Eric Hare at Autodesk, who was, you know, their chief operating officer at the time. He was like, he was brutal. And, you know, it was not, they did not want a win-win situation. And we did okay, but like, you know, it wasn't like the sale of Softimage to, you know, Danielle did like 10 times better than any of us did.
Right.
But we did fine, and I'm not complaining, but it was a really tough year. And I ended up having like a couple little strokes that year and a couple heart attacks. Oof. It was a tough year.
Yeah.
And I just like, I had to get out. So a lot of people noticed my very abrupt departure from, it was like, I was balls to the wall on this 3D studio thing for like 10 years. And then poof, I disappeared. And I never really talked about it much. In fact, I hid all of my health issues really, really well throughout that period. And I would overcompensate by every time I would show up at Autodesk or at a trade show. It was all like Hawaiian shirts and flip-flops, and I had a ponytail, and it was like the ponytailed Yoast is on the scene, and I just made it look like it was all effortless on our part. And remember, we were five guys doing what Alias was doing with this huge team of, I don't remember how many, but we're talking dozens, 50 people, I think, on that team.
And five guys.
And we were five guys, and we were eating their lunch, you know? And and you can imagine the kind of stress that caused. It was really bad. And we were all, like, happy to get out. I mean, Tom was ready to just stick with it. And, of course, he's still the, you know, he's the reason why it's really going as strong as it is, along with a couple other people there. But Tom being product manager now is the greatest thing that could possibly happen for Max. And so you know, then I got out, and I'd also been frustrated for the last few years that I wasn't able to be creative. That whole Cerulli Studios thing that I had, you know, fantasized about when I was a teenager never really came to pass. I was making tools that allowed other people could to achieve that. You know, we used to I used to give these talks at SIGGRAPH, you know, for you know, lots of people would show up to our Autodesk user events. At, you know, I don't know, 1,000 people, whatever, all of our users would show up. We'd have these big parties. And I would give this talk that, you know, 3D Studio was just a finger pointing at the moon. You know, like it's just this step along the way. You know, our goal was really to give people the freedom to be ultimately visually creative in their basements. And people would always send me letters and things about how they were able to take out this small loan and quit their, you know, boring job for the man and, you know, start up shop in their basement and support their family and how grateful they were. And I was jealous all about all these, like, I'm killing myself here. And all these guys are having all this great time being creative. I couldn't even get time to use my tools. I'm making teapots.
And, developer
and,
art.
And icosahedra, you know what I mean? I'm making shit like bounce around. So I was really frustrated. In addition to all these health issues and things, I was just really frustrated. And it really wasn't just about synthetic imagery for me. I, you know, I'd been a wannabe filmmaker when I was a kid, you know. I once got Francois Truffaut to sign my 8mm camera.
Oh my gosh. Are you serious?
No, at Avery Fisher Hall at the premiere of Story of Adele H. I was in high school. I was in film production class, and I had a camera that belonged to the school, and I brought a green Sharpie, and I, you know, I waylaid him, you know, I ambushed him on his way out of the box at Avery Fisher Hall, Lincoln Center. And I held up my camera with the Sharpie. I was like, Maestro, please sign my camera. He's like, what the fuck? And he takes the thing and he signs the camera. And I had this camera signed by Francois Truffaut, who was real. He was really one of my biggest idols. And so this was always like this dream. I wanted to be a filmmaker. I had been kind of caught in this backwater of synthetic imagery. It wasn't particularly satisfying to me on the storytelling level. And so we, you know, we sold out, and I actually had some more surgeries. And luckily, the surgeries I had in 1999 basically solved all of my problems, and I became super healthy for the first time in my life.
Wow, that's nice.
And have been for the last, whatever, 21 years.
Right.
And that... you know, my wife and I adopted this beautiful girl from China in the year 2000. And then I, you know, I started, like, there weren't digital movie cameras at the time, but I got, like, the first little Nikon digital cameras. And I started taking, you know, I got Photoshop and taking pictures, and I was like, oh, raw files, and oh, that's really interesting. And I got more and more into photography until then eventually, you know, you could, you know, make little movies with these cameras. And I started making movies, and I made a movie about, I had been a volunteer fire lookout on top of our local mountain, Mount Tamalpais.
Okay. Yeah.
And over the 2009, 10, 11, I would take a lot of pictures. I started making little movies with like whatever little video capabilities there were. I made one in 2012 called Day in the Life of a Fire Lookout that won a Vimeo Staff Pick Award and went viral. And it was like, whoa, I could be a filmmaker. I'm a filmmaker now.
That's awesome.
It was great. It was like, oh, you know, Cerulli Studios is coming. And I then just started getting more and more into, you know, making films from 2012 to 2017, late 2017, early 2018. And then I started noticing all this, you know, 360 video stuff starting to happen.
All right. Yeah.
And it was like, oh, this is interesting.
Well, I remember that as like QuickTime VR was around 90, like that time.
QuickTime VR, but there were no real tools to make stereoscopic.
Right. No.
360, like 360 video actually wasn't very interesting to me, but to do it, you know, in stereo.
Right.
That was interesting. Mm-hmm. And so 3 years ago, I didn't really want to build a GoPro rig. I had read about all these synchronization issues and trying to get stereo out of those. It was not very good. Mm-hmm. And so there was this camera, there's this Insta360 camera. It was like a ball size of a grapefruit. And I bought one of those in late 2017 and did some tests, and it was, I don't know, I don't want to be disparaging to anybody. Let's just say it didn't live up to my expectations.
This isn't the one that you throw up in the air, is it?
No. It was like a $3,000 camera.
Oh, okay.
And it just had six lenses, and the overlap, there just wasn't much overlap. I could not get really good parallax. I couldn't get a satisfying stereo image out of this camera. And I was really excited about, you know, 3D, and I thought, wow, this integrates my 3D experience and my filmmaking and like finally blah, blah, blah. And, but then I got very disappointed. It was like that ISDN experience. Like I was super hot to go, but then blah. And then a really, really good friend of mine and one of my partners, and actually one of the members on the board of this nonprofit that I'm about to get to tell you about, bring you up to speed. This guy named David Lawrence, he had been at ILM, and he's just one of my great friends now. And he told me about this guy in Shenzhen in China named Kinson Liu, who had a company called Zcam. And they had this $35,000 V1 Pro camera with, you know, it was like nine lenses, eight around and one up. And it was known for really great stereo imaging. And there was like, no way I'm going to spend $35,000. But David said that Kinson had a new camera under development, which was like the low-cost $10,000 version of that. And so I sent, you know, this guy, Kinson Liu, an email like, I'm this filmmaker in San Francisco, and I heard you got this thing, and it's like, I don't know. So he says, well, I'm coming to San Francisco in 2 weeks, and I have something to show you. And so he comes out in 2 weeks and shows me and Dave, we go to lunch. He takes this thing out of his bag, which it's actually in the other room, but looks like this coffee can, and it has 10 lenses. 10?
Okay.
It's like the size of a Maxwell House coffee can with these 10 small lenses around. And he goes, and then he takes out a Gear VR headset from his bag, and he says, take a look at this. And he shows me some video produced with this prototype camera. And it's like 3 feet away from these people at this restaurant in Hong Kong eating this great meal. And it's like, you could just go out and you could touch the food. And it was like the quality of the stereo was so good. And that's because there's like this insane amount of overlap.
Between the lenses, yeah.
And I'm like, Kinson, I am your man. I am your prototypical indie filmmaker who wants to use a tool like this, you know, to produce immersive cinema.
Right.
And he's like, great, I will give you this camera. And he handed it to me. And he said, I have another one. We have two prototypes. This is one, and there's another one. And you and me will have the only cameras for the next 6 months, and you can crank shit out and tell me, you know, what's wrong with it. And the short story is there really wasn't a lot wrong with it.
Okay.
And I was producing incredible quality footage. And there's this guy, Roman Dudek, in Spain, who worked for a company called Mystica, who made a Stitcher called Mystica VR. Which I sent him some data. He made a calibration profile, and it gave me all the tools I needed to work with that stereo data. Okay. And then I got the first one of those cameras in June of 2018, and then I was thinking, like, what am I going to do with this? So now I can do this, and I've got my little 3D 360 studio set up.
Yeah.
What is it good for? And I hadn't done a whole bunch of tests. I'd done a lot of tests, and I thought, well, you know what? It can record this sense of presence. And I was talking to a friend of mine about this, who lived in Hawaii, who actually happened to be the physician for a spiritual teacher, Ram Dass. Mm. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he wrote a book called Be Here Now in the early 70s. And I had actually spent some time with him when I was 15. I happened to run into his little commune while I was on a road trip with one of my friends. And we spent a couple of days there. And I remember, like, oh, my friend said, I'm Ram Dass's doctor. You could do, he's not really well. You could do an experience with him. And they call these like a darshan experience, where you're present in the presence of a teacher. And you know, he's probably going to die soon. So let's get something recorded. And I went out to Maui with this camera, and I recorded him. I recorded another friend of mine relaying a powerful experience he had. I brought this footage home. I looked at it, and you know, I was like, this is actually really powerful to have this, this direct connection. And I have a friend of mine who's an actor, Peter Coyote. And I asked him, he had helped me write the script for one of my films about Mount Tam, The Invisible Peak, and he narrated it. And I called him up. I was like, hey, man, you're a Zen priest. Let's do one of these teachings. And so we did one with him. And I was like, this is really something to this. And I did another like half a dozen of those over the next few months. And then at some point, a brilliant engineer at Oculus named Eric Chang sent me an email and said that, hey, you know, we like what you're doing with this stuff. We'd like you to do more, and we'd like to throw a little bit of money at you to kind of step it up to the next level. And I said, you know, if you give me any money, I'm going to give it all to this friend of mine named Adam Lofton, who is this brilliant director, and I'll bring him in. I'll be the technologist. I don't really need the money that badly. I'm doing okay.
Okay.
Adam's got a young kid. Let's give all that money to Adam, and we'll direct 8 experiences that have much more intention behind them than just setting up the camera. And we did 8 of those things, and there's like 3 of them were just amazing, and the other ones were really good, and they really proved that we could do something. And over the course of that, I thought, well, this is something that I could do for a long time. And a friend of mine convinced me to set up a nonprofit. And we set up this nonprofit called the Wisdom VR Project. www.wisdomvr.org, right? That's my email address.
That's your email, yeah.
So we went to the trouble of, you know, setting up this IRS 501c3, which is, you know, they're not trivial, but wasn't the hardest thing in the world. And so we did these 9, and they're like, what are we going to do? And then a friend of mine here, after the pandemic started and the shutdown was happening, and I thought, ugh, you know, we're going nowhere now. And but she told me about this incredible emergency room doctor who had just gotten sick with COVID-19 and almost died, and he might make a great subject for a Wisdom VR project. And
interesting.
He lived in Santa Fe. He operated 5 emergency departments, 4 in California, 1 in Los Alamos. And so on his next trip out here, we sat down on my patio, and the guy had a lot of charisma, and it was obvious that there was a really good story into the pandemic through his eyes. Really,
yeah,
unique. I mean, he had 4 pulmonary embolisms and had massive inflammation, and came very, very close to dying. And he also was like trying to save people's lives
at the same time. Yeah.
And so it was a great story. I thought, well, this is a good one. And we had CT data for him, and I found a company that could do 3D visualization of the CT data. So I made a proposal to Oculus again. It was like, hey, we could do this. This is kind of interesting. They're like, oh yeah, that is kind of interesting. And we kind of got started on telling the story. And we saw that the story definitely had this human perspective, and it had kind of a big macro perspective about how the global situation it was really exacerbating the pandemic, you know, climate change and, you know, economic disparities and racial strife, all that. So we were kind of telling the story within that context, but then we didn't have this kind of microscopic cellular level, and it was like 3D studio, you know? This is what 3D animation is for. It was like the whole joke about
you finally got to use your software.
Surreali Studios is coming, right? So it's like, we used to talk about how, you know, the reason for 3D animation is like if it's too small, if it's too large, if it goes too fast, if it goes too slow, those are the greatest, you know, opportunities for 3D animation. And so I, you know, my first thought was like, who do I know who's a great scientific animator? And coincidentally, one of our beta testers, you know, way back with Max, who I had been in touch with, a really sweet guy named Andy Murdoch, who had a little independent studio called Lands of Robots, Lots of Robots.
Lots of Robots. L-O-R. Yeah, of course, I remember that guy. Yes, because I was a beta tester too, and I was on a lot of the panels, so I remember him very
Well, and if you'd ever seen him, he's like a 6'4" Viking with red hair and just the sweetest guy. And I'd, you know, been a Facebook friend with him, and coincidentally, he and his family moved from San Francisco to Mill Valley, like down the street.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And in January, I invited him over to put a set of, you know, goggles on him.
Yep.
And show him what I was doing with the Wisdom VR project. And, you know, I was, you know, so excited about, you know, my new thing. And so that was in January. And we didn't, you know, soon after that, the shutdown happened. And I hadn't really talked to him. And then in July, after we kind of got rolling on this, I remembered he had told me that he was bored.
Oh.
He was raising his 2 daughters. He wasn't doing a lot of creative work. And I remembered that he had worked with National Geographic over like a decade, more than a decade. His work had been nominated for multiple Emmy Awards.
Okay.
For scientific visualization, like including cellular shit.
Right.
And I was like, holy shit, this was under my nose the entire time.
Wow.
So, I was like, hey, Andy, you want to play? And we didn't have much money, but like, you could be like super creative.
Right.
And it could be about the pandemic, and it's like incredibly relevant. And, you know, we've got this story, and, you know, I've got this amazing camera, of which, by the way, there are only 20 in the world before Zcam stopped making them.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah, it was this weird custom lens. Then they stopped making the lens, and they're like, okay, this whole backwater of 3D immersive video is not making any money for us anyway. And we're just back. So I've got one of 20 of these cameras. Andy was pretty impressed with the quality of our stereo. We actually produce the best stereoscopic imaging, you know, of any 3D, 360 immersive studio on the planet who is using off-the-shelf hardware, turnkey hardware. Okay. I mean, Felix and Paul in Toronto do a really great job. All that stuff is custom built, although they're using the Zcam V1 Pro up on the space station right now. They've got they got 2 of them. There was a big SIGGRAPH presentation last year about that, which is pretty incredible.
Right.
But so Andy was excited enough to say, yeah, I'm in. So, you know, we start doing some tests, and he does some really great things inside the cytoplasm of the cell and the virons. And it becomes obvious really fast that we have to produce like 7 minutes of animation in 2 months. And not only this, get this, Chris, it's 7K by 7K.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
So, you need some render power.
So there was like 50 megapixel images.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
7 minutes in 2 months.
Uh-huh.
With a guy and a computer.
Yeah.
And so we have, he has like a 5-year-old box computer with like an ancient NVIDIA card. So the first thing we do is we call up one of our old product managers, Frank DeLise, who's over at NVIDIA now. And it's like, hey, Frank, we're doing this really cool project about the pandemic. Do you think you can throw like some Titan cards at us?
Right.
And he's like, yeah, absolutely. No problem. What's your address, Andy? And then, you know, Andy buys a new box machine, you know, and we, and we get two Titan cards, like a Titan RTX. And then it's like, well, you know, we have all this rendering to do. And I didn't even know what Phil Miller was doing at the time. I knew that he wasn't at NVIDIA anymore. And Andy goes, you know, Phil is at Chaos Group now.
Right.
And Andy had been showing me all these tests he'd done, even in January when we got together again. He was showing me all these tests he'd done with Tyflow.
Oh, right, right, right.
And Tyson, Tyson is just this crazy genius.
Yeah.
And I was really impressed, and it had been in the back of my mind, like, oh yeah, one day I want to do something with Tyflow and Max. This is just too cool. This is like a dream. And so he said, I've been doing these experiments with Tyflow, and there's this fur shader in V-Ray that has like tremendous potential for complexity. You know, we can use it for a lot more than fur. And we can use it for like this, this phospholipid bilayer thing that is around all of our epithelial cells. And we can do it for all the cilia on the outside of the epithelial. He's like, we can use this fur shader for everything. And not only that, they have this cloud rendering platform at Chaos Group. And it's called the Chaos Cloud. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we could theoretically just like actually render this stuff. And so, Phil, hi, Phil, been a long time. How you doing? Here's our, we're doing this really great project about the pandemic. It's probably like the most amazing creative project you could possibly do about the pandemic. We're giving people an immersive experience, you know, at the, you know, human level, at the macro level, and at the microscopic level,
which
we could only do inside of Max, and we can only really achieve these kinds of render outcomes with your cloud. And like, do you think this is something that would interest, you know, the people in, you know, in Europe?
Right.
And so, you know, he made a presentation. They're like, yeah, this is actually, you know, pretty cool. Somebody asked, like, do you think Yoast can actually do this?
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, Phil, I'm sure, you know, he attested to my indomitable power of will to pretty much produce anything. You know, I always think if I can produce a hologram of it in my mind, it's just like a series of steps. My mom always used to say, really, there's nothing in the world that's hard. It's just like, how many steps does it have? So it has like 1,000 steps. Little did I know back in July that that doing a half an hour stereoscopic, you know, 360 degree piece with 85 7K video shots, like stereoscopic video shots, along with 7 minutes of animation and, you know, the original music and everything that goes along with everything like this, you know, would actually put me in a state of being that was as intense as anything I ever experienced back in the Max days. Like, you know, I didn't think I was going to be doing 18-hour days back to back for weeks and weeks at a time ever again.
Right.
And I'm 61 now, man. I'm not really built for it. I mean, I usually like hike around and stuff, and I work 4 or 5 hours in front of the computer a day, and I like to cook and hang out with my family and watch movies, and, you know, I like to have a life. We used to, the old days, it was all like, oh, we're on the deferred life plan, you know, and we're going to, you know, one day have a life. And I actually had a life for like 20 years. And then this project came along. It's like, what? You know, it just blew up into that exact same state. Of course, this is going to end on November 12th, which is when our deadline is, which is like 25 days away.
Right.
And as long as long as Phil keeps funneling credits into Andy's account, we will actually make it.
I think you'll make it.
I think we're gonna get pretty close. I mean, it's intense. I mean, you know, we're thinking.
I'm excited because it's right around the time that you know this podcast is going to come out. It's 30 years of 3D Studio.
You're right.
And it's my 300th episode of this podcast.
Oh, no way.
Yep. Perfect. So it's all coming together.
No kidding.
I think it's going to,
So you totally get it. A lot of people who haven't seen me or my work over the last 30 years can't really appreciate what this moment is all about. And I can even talk to my old buddies on the phone, you know, about Cerulli Studios. Like, ha, finally did it.
Right.
2020 might have been a fucking shit year, but finally did it.
Yep.
And so
yeah, you in the 70s thinking about what you were going to do in that studio.
Right.
You
know? And we were thinking of 2020 and what we were going to do in the pandemic. And so, you know, it's been really hard, you know. Last week physically it was particularly hard. Like my whole right side was in pain but I've done, you know, I managed to fit in some early morning hikes. I've been hiking down to the back of Muir Woods at 6:30 in the morning, doing these 7 mile hikes 3 times a week and just doing a lot of like Qigong and stuff and getting my Qi going and meditating more. I feel good.
Good.
And my partner, Adam, due to family issues, he had to actually move to the jungles of Hawaii this Sunday because, I guess, you know, his family needed him there.
Right.
And he has his, so we had to, you know, I've got these very powerful machines here in my studio, $20,000 Mac Pro. And I'm talking to you on a super beefed up iMac Pro. And there's a PC down over there. He's using my machines from his laptop remotely from the jungle, but he's got little solar panels on his roof with these little batteries. And like, we have to, you know, allocate what time he's going to be online with me. And so we're doing all the final posts. We've been doing all this conforming and Premiere and stuff, you know, and he's a perfectionist. And like I said, I'm ADHD and I'm very nonlinear, and I haven't done all this very detailed work. I used to be good at it back in the Max days. I had my techniques. It's been a long time since I had to be super kind of obsessive compulsive about details. And I'm constantly, I wouldn't say pissing Adam off, but I'm constantly disappointing Adam with my lack of perfect adherence to standards. Because you can imagine with every one of these video shots, it all has to go through rig removal and, you know, Zenith cleanup and shadow removal. And then, you know, compositing in a lot of cases and then sharpening. And so, you know, and then everything, you know, has to go into these bins that where we can do these conforming processes really easily. And it, you know, I've got these big spreadsheets and everything, but it's really hard to keep it all straight when you've got, you know, almost 100 of these gigantic shots, 7K by 7K. You know, ProRes shots that are living in, you know, 6 different places.
Wow.
So I've managed to stay ahead of Adam's wrath. But he's been really patient with me, and we're doing a good job. I mean, we're going to make it. I mean, the music's going to be great. Everything's going to be great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait. I just actually went to our office because I've been working from home like everyone else, but I drove to the office to pick up the VR headset to bring it back to home with me so that I'll make sure that I can check it out in VR when you're able to share it with me for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we'll, you know, of course the 3D animation is the last thing that's going to get in there.
Sure.
Right? So today is the 15th. Our goal actually is to have all the animation done by November 1st.
Right.
And Andy and I just went over the schedule this morning, and, you know, he's already got all the environments done, and we've got, you know, we've got 13 shots and we've got 6 shots in the can. And the next 3 are the really complicated ones, but all the environments are done, and we've allocated like almost 9 days for the next 3 shots. And then the other 4 shots are very simple, and we've allocated like a day and a half or 2 days for each of those shots.
Okay.
And that gets us to the first. And he's just so experienced at production on these things and working with Nat Geo, that I don't think there's anyone else I would really trust on this kind of schedule, you know, but it's just been a joy to work with them.
Well, the cool thing about cloud is that, you know, you just, if you need a lot of frames, you'll just get a lot of computers.
Unbelievable. It's right. It's amazing. Like shots that would take his machine days and days are done in an hour.
Yeah, I know.
And he's found some bugs in the cloud, by the way.
That's good. Good. That's why we need him.
He's been funneling them, and you know, Phil's been really great about that. And we're doing really great. So absolutely, you know, Chaos Cloud is the enabling technology behind all the visualization in this piece.
That's awesome.
You know, it's going to be out on Oculus TV, and it'll be featured as a it'll be an Oculus TV as a 3D 360 piece, but I don't know if you know about Oculus Venues and this Facebook Horizons thing. It's like,
I've heard. Go ahead and tell our listeners.
Facebook has
here.
This idea, the metaverse, you know, Ready Player One, kind of, you know, that the what did they call that in Ready Player One?
What was it called?
I forget. I forget.
Yeah.
You know, that thing.
The grid? No, not the grid. That's Tron.
The metaverse.
I get it.
And so Facebook has an alpha of an early version of this called Horizons. And in Horizons, there's a place you can go called Venues, and it's a virtual six-off movie theater, and you and your friends can hang out in a lobby for a while. And then you can walk into a theater, and you're six-off in the theater, but you know, you're looking up at this screen, and what you're seeing is a monoscopic 180 film together. Because, of course, you can't mix some arbitrary stereoscopic 360 thing that's three-off. With the sixth off world, you'd get an instant headache.
So
it's like a traditional theater. Like you and your friends can.
It's like a dome theater, basically.
It's like a super CinemaScope, you know, 180 by one. It's a 180 by 180, basically. It's from, you know.
Right.
And so it'll be featured. They'll do a feature of it there, and then it'll live on Oculus TV and, it'll get what it gets. But we're also going to do an HD cut of the visualization stuff for Chaos. So we'll do, you know, whatever it is. I mean, 4-minute piece where we will narrate. Like in the film, the film is really about story, and it's about his story. And we don't go into talking about the details of what's happening in the cytoplasm when, you know, the Viron gets invaginated through endocytosis and releases its RNA, which, you know, is transcribed by the ribosomes into these new proteins that migrate through, you know, exocytosis back into the nasal pharynx and all this stuff. We don't get into boring people that. We just show it to them, right? But we will do a boring HD cut from the 360 video for Chaos. So you guys can use that, like, this is pretty cool, right? And then, of course, you can point to all your customers who have headsets to look at this piece.
For sure.
So that's the story. So you asked, like, how this all started.
Yeah.
And I pretty much think I took you.
You took me through the whole story the last 40 years.
to this very moment, right?
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. I'm very excited. I'm very excited about this. And I'm very excited about the fact that we got to, you know, talk to you. I just, you know, when Phil was telling me about this, because Phil, I sort of run the labs thing. And so Phil and I and Lon and Vlado, we all get on our call on Thursdays. And he's like, well, Gary called me about this crazy VR thing he wants to do. He wants to use Cloud. He wants to use Tyflow. He's in love with V-Ray. I was like, well, that's great. And he goes, not only should you do that, but we should have him on the podcast.
Right on.
It was a perfect idea. So I was very excited and totally think that this is a great opportunity for us to do things and to try new things as well. You know, it's been really, really cool to do that for sure.
Yeah. And how many of your customers have been doing, you know, stereoscopic high-res 360 video?
A lot, actually.
Really?
Not video as much. Not as much as what you're doing, but there's a lot of architecture people that are doing a lot of 360.
Right, that's where it is.
Because it just makes sense in architecture, right? So,
but you know what? I think Phil told me this. Phil told me this recently. It makes a lot of sense to do with architecture, but the thing that architects hate about showing their clients visualizations in the headset is that they can't see their facial expressions.
Yes. When they put the headset on.
When they put the headset on.
Yep.
So they can't read them.
Yep.
And Phil says it's kind of a deal breaker for a lot of architects because they depend on that visual connection with their customers so much.
Yeah.
It's interesting, huh?
Yeah, it's weird. There's a lot of, but it, you know, the whole point of VR is to take you to a place that you haven't been before or doesn't
exist.
Or that you can't visualize. And so architecture is just like the perfect world for that. But you're right. Yeah. Yeah.
I agree. I think the architects have to give up that, you know, archaic notion of reading the face of the client and just know that, you know, they can get the information they need from the client and that the client is getting the highest quality presentation of their data that they could possibly get.
Yeah. For sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Well, cool. I don't want to take too much more of your time because I think we've gotten a huge amount of story.
Went soup to nuts on here.
Soup to nuts. So, but I really appreciate it. I was going to warn you that basically your video has been going in and out. So I'll probably just have a still of you for the video if that's okay. But I got all the audio. So we're all set on the audio.
The podcast itself is an audio podcast.
It's an audio only, but sometimes we put a video up for people who want to watch videos. But mostly, 99% of people just listen to the audio.
I don't care if anyone watches it, of course. really?
Yeah, it's cool. Listen, this has been amazing. Like I said, if someone had told me that I'm going to be having, you know, a podcast at some point and then in my 300th episode, I'm going to be interviewing Gary Yost, I would say like, that's not going to happen. But it did. And so here I am.
It's not going to happen because he's probably dead.
No, you're not dead, but you're definitely very alive. You're alive with amazing ideas. I'm so glad you were able to think about, you know, that thing back in the 70s, and here you are actually making things and finally using 3D Studio for your own good and for your own creation. So that's wonderful.
Well, thank you for being a part of it, man. Chaos Labs, and you know, who would have known that V-Ray was going to become such an integral part of me achieving my dream.
I know. That's wonderful. I'm really glad we're able to make that happen for you. So that's been really great.
Yeah.
So thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me, Chris. You take care.